Here, I've got you, Tim said, feeling simultaneously foolish and not foolish at all. You can, be quiet now. Silence from the silver disc. Tim sat still for perhaps 5 minutes, listening to the night noises of the forest, not so threatening as those in the swamp, at least so far, and getting himself under control. Then he said, "Yes, Si, I'd like a light." The disc commenced the same low whining noise it had made when it brought forth the stick, and suddenly a white light, so brilliant it made Tim temporarily blind, shone out. The trees leaped into being all around him, and some creature that had crept close without making a sound leaped back with a startled "yark" sound. Tim's eyes were still too dazzled for him to get a good look, but he had an impression of a smooth-furred body and, perhaps, a squiggle of tail. A second stick had emerged from the plate. At the top, a small, hooded bulge was producing that furious glare. It was like burning phosphorus, but unlike phosphorus, it did not burn out. Tim had no idea how sticks and lights could hide in a metal plate so thin and didn't care. One thing he did care about. "How long will it last, my lady?" "Your question is non-specific, traveler. Rephrase." "How long will the light last?" "Battery power is 88%. Projected life is 70 years, plus or minus 2.
70 years, Tim thought. That should be enough.
He began picking up and repacking his gunna. With the bright glare to guide him, the path he was following was even clearer than it had been on the edge of the swamp, but it sloped steadily upward, and by midnight, if it was midnight, he had no way of telling. Tim was tired out, in spite of his long sleep in the boat. The oppressive and unnatural heat continued, and that didn't help. Neither did the weight of the hamper and the water skin. At last he sat, put the disc down beside him, opened the hamper, and munched one of the popkins. It was delicious. He considered a second, then reminded himself he didn't know how long he would have to make these rations last. It also crossed his mind that the brilliant light shining from the disc could be seen by anything that happened to be in the vicinity, and some of those things might not be friendly. "Would you turn the light off, lady?" He wasn't sure she would respond. He had tried several conversational gambits in the last 4 or 5 hours with no result, but the light went off, plunging him into utter darkness. At once Tim seemed to sense living things all around him. Boars, woods wolves, verts, mayhap a pookie or two, and he had to restrain an urge to ask for the light again. These ironwoods seemed to know it was wide earth in spite of the unnatural heat, and had sprinkled down plenty of year-end duff, mostly on the flowers that surrounded their bases, but also beyond them. Tim gathered up enough to make a jackleg bed, and lay down upon it. "I've gone jippa," he thought, the unpleasant tree term for people who lost their minds. But he didn't feel jippa. What he felt was full and content, although he missed the Fagonarders and worried about them. "I'm going to sleep," he said. "Will you wake me if something comes, Si?" She responded, but not in a way Tim understood. "Directive 19. That's the one after 18 and before 20, Tim thought, and closed his eyes. He began to drift at once. He thought to ask the disembodied female voice another question. Did they speak to the swamp people? But by then, he was gone. In the deepest crease of the night, Tim Ross's part of the endless forest came alive with small, creeping forms. Within the sophisticated device marked North Central Positronics Portable Guidance Module Daria, NCP-143635-AN. The ghost in the machine marked the approach of these creatures, but remained silent, sensing no danger. Tim slept on. The Thraken, six in all, gathered around the slumbering boy in a loose semicircle. For a while they watched him with their strange, gold-ringed eyes, but then they turned north and raised their snouts in the air. Above the northernmost reaches of Midworld, where the snows never end and new earth never comes, a great funnel had begun to form, turning an air lately arrived from the south that was far too warm. As it began to breathe like a lung, it sucked up a moiety of frigid air from below and began to turn faster, creating a self-sustaining energy pump. Soon the outer edges found the path of the beam, which guidance module Daria read electronically and which Tim Ross saw as a faint path through the woods. The beam tasted the storm, found it good, and sucked it in. The Stark Blast began to move south, slowly at first, then faster. Tim awoke to birdsong and sat up, rubbing his eyes. For a moment he didn't know where he was, but the sight of the hamper and the greenish shafts of sunlight falling through the high tops of the ironwood trees soon set him in place. He stood up, started to step off the path to do his morning necessary, then paused. He saw several tight little bundles of scat around the place where he had slept, and wondered what had come to investigate him in the night. Something smaller than wolves, he thought. Let that be enough. He unbuttoned his flies and took care of his business. When he finished, he repacked the hamper, a little surprised that his visitors hadn't raided it, had a drink from the waterskin, and picked up the silver disc. His eye fell on the third button. The Widow Smack spoke up inside his head, telling him not to push it, to leave well enough alone, but Tim decided this was advice he would disregard. If he had paid attention to well-meaning advice, he wouldn't be here. Of course, his mother might also have her sight, but Big Kells would still be a steppa. He supposed all of life was full of similar traits. Hoping the damn thing wouldn't explode, Tim pushed the button. "Hello, traveler," the woman's voice said. Tim began to hello her back, but she went on without acknowledging him. "Welcome to Daria, a guidance service of North Central Positronics. You are on the beam of the cat, sometimes known as the beam of the lion or of the tiger. You are also on the way of the bird, known variously as the way of the eagle, the way of the hawk, and the way of the vulturine. All things serve the beam." "So they do say," Tim agreed, so wonderstruck he was hardly aware he was speaking, although no one knows what it means. "You have left Waypoint 9 in Fagonard Swamp. There is no Dogon in Fagonard Swamp, but there is a charging station. If you need a charging station, say yes, and I will compute your course. If you do not need a charging station, say, continue." "Continue," Tim said. "Lady?"
"Daria, I seek Merlin."
She overrode him.
"The next Dogon on the current course is on the North Forest Kinnock, also known as the Northern Airy. The charging station at the North Forest Kinnock Dogon is offline. Disturbance in the beam suggests magic at that location. There may also be changed life at that location. Detour is recommended. If you would like to detour, say detour, and I will compute the necessary changes. If you would like to visit the North Forest Kinnock Dogon, also known as Northern Airy, say continue." Tim considered the choices. If the Daria thing was suggesting a detour, this Dogon place was probably dangerous. On the other hand, wasn't magic exactly what he had come in search of? Magic or a miracle? And he'd already stood on the head of a dragon. How much more dangerous could the North Forest Kinnock Dogon be? Maybe a lot, he admitted to himself. But he had his father's axe, he had his father's lucky coin, and he had a foreshot. One that worked, and had already drawn blood. "Continue," he said. "The distance to the North Forest Kinnock Dogon is 50 miles, or 45.45 wheels. The terrain is moderate. Weather conditions?" Daria paused. There was a loud click. Then, "Directive 19. "What is Directive 19, Daria?" "To bypass Directive 19, speak your password. You may be asked to spell." I don't know what that means.
Are you sure you would not like me to plot a detour, traveler? I am detecting a strong disturbance in the beam, indicating deep magic.
Is it white magic or black?
It was as close as Tim could come to asking a question the voice from the plate probably wouldn't understand.
Is it Merlin, or is it the man who got Mama and me into this mess?
When there was no answer for 10 seconds, Tim began to believe there would be no answer at all, or another repetition of Directive 19, which really amounted to the same thing. But an answer came back, although it did him little good.
Both, said Daria.
His way continued upward, and the heat continued as well. By noon, Tim was too tired and hungry to go on. He had tried several times to engage Daria in conversation, but she had once again gone silent. Pushing the third button did not help, although her navigation function seemed unimpaired. When he deliberately turned to the right or left of the discernible path leading ever deeper into the woods and ever upward, the green light turned red. When he turned back, the green reappeared. He ate from the hamper, then settled in for a nap. When he awoke, it was late afternoon and a little cooler. He reslung the hamper on his back, it was lighter now, shouldered the water skin and pushed ahead. The afternoon was short, and the twilight even shorter. The night held fewer terrors for him, partly because he had already survived one, but mostly because, when he called for the light, Daria provided it. And after the heat of the day, the cool of the evening was refreshing. Tim went on for a good many hours before he began to tire again. He was gathering some duff to sleep on until daylight when Daria spoke up.
There is a scenic opportunity ahead, traveler. If you wish to take advantage of this scenic opportunity, say continue. If you do not wish to observe, say no.
Tim had been in the act of putting the hamper on the ground. Now he picked it up again, intrigued.
Continue, he said.
The disc's bright light went out, but after Tim's eyes had a chance to adjust, he saw light up ahead. Only moonlight, but far brighter than that which filtered through the trees overhanging the path.
Use the green navigation sensor, Daria said. Move quietly. The scenic opportunity is 1 mile or 0.8 wheels north of your current location.
With that, she clicked off.
Tim moved as quietly as he could, but to himself he sounded very loud. In the end, it probably made no difference. The path opened into the first large clearing he had come to since entering the forest, and the beings occupying it took no notice of him at all. There were 6 billy bumblers sitting on a fallen ironwood tree with their snouts raised to the crescent moon. Their eyes gleamed like jewels. Thraken were hardly ever seen in tree these days, and to see even one was considered extremely lucky. Tim never had. Several of his friends claimed to have glimpsed them at play in the fields or in the bossy groves, but he suspected they were fibbing. And now, to see a full half dozen. They were, he thought, far more beautiful than the treacherous Armenita, because the only magic about them was the plain magic of living things.
These were the creatures that surrounded me last night. I know they were. He approached them as in a dream, knowing he would probably frighten them away, but helpless to stay where he was. They did not move. He stretched his hand out to one, ignoring the doleful voice in his head, it sounded like the widow's, telling him he would certainly be bitten. The bumbler did not bite, but when it felt Tim's fingers in the dense fur below the shelf of its jaw, it seemed to awake. It leaped from the log. The others did the same. They began to chase around his feet and between his legs, nipping at each other and uttering high-pitched barks that made Tim laugh. One looked over its shoulder at him and seemed to laugh back. They left him and raced to the center of the clearing. There they made a moving ring in the moonlight, their faint shadows dancing and weaving. They all stopped at once and rose on their hind legs with their paws outstretched, looking for all the world like little furry men. Beneath the cold smile of the crescent moon, they all face north along the path of the beam.
"You're wonderful," Tim called.
They turned to him, concentration broken.
"Wonderful,"
one of them said, and then they all raced into the trees. It happened so quickly that Tim almost believed he had imagined the whole thing. Almost. He made camp in the clearing that night, hoping they might return. And as he drifted towards sleep, he remembered something the Widow Smack had said about the unseasonably warm weather.
"It's probably nothing, unless you see Sir Thrawken dancing in the starlight, or looking north with his muzzle upraised."
He had seen not just one bumbler, but a full half-dozen doing both. Tim sat up. The Widow had said those things were a sign of something, what, a stun blast? That was close, but not quite.
"Stark blast," he said. That was it.
"Stark blast," Daria said, startling him more wide awake than ever. "A fast-moving storm of great power. Its features include steep and sudden drops in temperature accompanied by strong winds. It has been known to cause major destruction and loss of life in civilized portions of the world. In primitive areas, entire tribes have been wiped out. This definition of Stark Blast has been a service of North Central Positronics." Tim lay down again on his bed of duff, arms crossed behind his head, looking up at the circle of stars this clearing made visible. A service of North Central Positronics, was it? Well, maybe. He had an idea it might really have been a service of Daria. She was a marvelous machine, although he wasn't sure a machine was all she was. But there were things she wasn't allowed to tell him. He had an idea she might be hinting at some of those things, though. Was she leading him on, as the Covenant Man and Armanita had done? Tim had to admit it was a possibility, but he didn't really believe it. He thought, possibly because he was just a stupid kid ready to believe anything, that maybe she hadn't had anyone to talk to for a long time, and had taken a shine to him. One thing he knew for sure, if there was a terrible storm coming, he would do well to finish his business quickly and then get undercover. But where would be safe? This led his musings back to the Fagonard tribe. They weren't a bit safe, as they knew, for hadn't they already imitated the bumblers for him? He had promised himself he would recognize what they were trying to show him if it was put before him. And he had. The storm was coming, the Stark Blast. They knew it, probably from the bumblers, and they expected it to kill them. With such thoughts in his mind, Tim guessed it would be a long time before he could get to sleep, but 5 minutes later, he was lost to the world. He dreamed of Thrawken dancing in the moonlight. He began to think of Daria as his companion, although she didn't speak much, and when she did, Tim didn't always understand why or what a gnar she was talking about. Once it was a series of numbers. Once she told him she would be offline because she was searching for satellite and suggested he stop. He did, and for half an hour the plate seemed completely dead. No lights, no voice. Just when he'd begun to believe she really had died, the green light came back on, the little stick reappeared, and Daria announced, "I have re-established satellite link." "Wish you joy of it," Tim replied. Several times she offered to calculate a detour. This Tim continued to decline, and once, near the end of the second day after leaving the Fagonard, she recited a bit of verse. "See the eagle's brilliant eye, and wings on which he holds the sky. He spies the land, and spies the sea, and even spies a child like me." If he lived to be 100, which, given his current mad errand, Tim doubted was in the cards, he thought he would never forget the things he saw on the 3 days he and Daria trudged ever upward in the continuing heat. The path, once vague, became a clear lane, one that for several wheels was bordered by crumbling rock walls. Once, for a space of almost an hour, the corridor in the sky above that lane was filled with thousands of red birds flying south, as if in migration. But surely, Tim thought, they must come to rest in the endless forest. For no birds like that had ever been seen above the village of Tree. Once, four blue deer less than 2 feet high crossed the path ahead of him, seeming to take no notice of the thunderstruck boy who stood staring at these muty dwarfs. And once they came to a field filled with giant yellow mushrooms standing 4 feet high, with caps the size of umbrellas. "Are they good to eat, Daria?" Tim asked, for he was reaching the end of the goods in the hamper. "Does thee know?" "No, traveler," Daria replied. "They are poison. If you even brush their dust on your skin, you will die of seizures. I advise extreme caution." This was advice Tim took, even holding his breath, until he was past that deadly grove filled with treacherous, sunshiny death. Near the end of the third day, he emerged on the edge of a narrow chasm that fell away for 1,000 feet or more. He could not see the bottom, for it was filled with a drift of white flowers. They were so thick that he at first mistook them for a cloud that had fallen to earth. The smell that wafted up to him was fantastically sweet. A rock bridge spanned this gorge, on the other side passing through a waterfall that glowed blood red in the reflected light of the setting sun. "Am I meant to cross that?" Tim asked faintly. It looked not much wider than a barn beam, and, in the middle, not much thicker. No answer from Daria, but the steadily glowing green light was answer enough. "Maybe in the morning," Tim said, knowing he would not sleep for thinking about it, but also not wanting to chance it so close to day's end. The idea of having to negotiate the last part of that lofty causeway in the dark was terrifying. "I advise you to cross now," Daria told him, "and continue to North Forest Kinnickdogan with all possible speed. Detour is no longer possible." Looking at the gorge with its chancy bridge, Tim hardly needed the voice from the plate to tell him that a detour was no longer possible, but still, "Why can't I wait until morning? Surely it would be safer." Directive 19. A click louder than any he had heard before came from the plate, and then Daria added, "But I advise speed, Tim." He had several times asked her to call him by name rather than as traveler. This was the first time she had done so, and it convinced him. He left the Fagonard tribe's basket, not without some regret, because he thought it might unbalance him. He tucked the last 2 popkins into his shirt, slung the waterskin over his back, then checked to make sure both the foreshot and his father's hand axe were firmly in place on either hip. He approached the stone causeway, looked down into the banks of white flowers, and saw the first shadows of evening beginning to pool there. He imagined himself making that one you-can-never-take-it-back misstep, saw himself whirling his arms in a fruitless effort to keep his balance, felt his feet first losing the rock and then running on air, heard his scream as the fall began. There would be a few moments to regret all the life he might have lived, and then... "Daria," he said in a small, sick voice, "do I have to?" No answer, which was answer enough. Tim stepped out over the drop. The sound of his boot heels on rock was very loud. He didn't want to look down, but had no choice. If he didn't mind where he was going, he would be doomed for sure. The rock bridge was as wide as a village path when he began, but by the time he got to the middle, as he had feared, although he had hoped it was just his eyes playing tricks, it was only the width of his shore boots. He tried walking with his arms outstretched, but a breeze came blowing down the gorge, billowing his shirt and making him feel like a kite about to lift off. He lowered them and walked on, heel to toe and heel to toe, wavering from side to side. He became convinced his heart was beating its last frenzied beats, his mind thinking its last random thoughts. "Mama will never know what happened to me." Halfway across, the bridge was at its narrowest, also its thinnest. Tim could feel its fragility through his feet, and could hear the wind playing its pitch pipe along its eroded underside. Now, each time he took a step, he had to swing a boot out over the drop. "Don't freeze," he told himself, but he knew that if he hesitated, he might do just that.
Then, from the corner of his eye, he saw movement below, and he did hesitate. Long, leathery tentacles were emerging from the flowers. They were slate gray on top, and as pink as burned skin underneath. They rose toward him in a wavery dance, first two, then four, then eight, then a forest of them. Daria again said, "I advise speed, Tim." He forced himself to start walking again. Slowly at first, but faster as the tentacles continued to close in. Surely no beast had a 1,000-foot reach, no matter how monstrous the body hiding down there in the flowers. But when Tim saw the tentacles thinning out and stretching to reach even higher, he began to hurry. And when the longest of them reached the underside of the bridge and began to fumble its way along it, he broke into a run. The waterfall, no longer red, now a fading pinkish orange, thundered ahead of him. Cold spray spattered his hot face. Tim felt something caress his boot, seeking purchase, and threw himself forward at the water with an inarticulate yell. There was one moment of freezing cold. It encased his body like a glove, and then he was on the other side of the falls and back on solid ground. One of the tentacles came through. It reared up like a snake, dripping, and then withdrew. "Daria, are you all right?" "I'm waterproof," Daria replied, with something that sounded suspiciously like smugness. Tim picked himself up and looked around. He was in a little rock cave. Written on one wall, in paint that once might have been red, but had over the years, or perhaps centuries, faded to dull rust, was this cryptic notation: John 3:16, fear hell, hope for heaven, man Jesus. Ahead of him was a short stone staircase filled with fading sunset light. To one side of it was a litter of tin cans and bits of broken machinery. Springs, wires, broken glass, and chunks of green board covered with squiggles of metal. On the other side of the stairs was a grinning skeleton with what looked like an ancient canteen draped over its ribcage. "Hello, Tim," that grin seemed to say. "Welcome to the far side of the world. Want a drink of dust? I have plenty." Tim climbed the stairs, skittering past the relic. He knew perfectly well it wouldn't come to life and try to snare him by the boot, as the tentacles from the flowers had tried to do. Dead was dead. Still, it seemed safer to skitter. When he emerged, he saw that the path once more entered the woods, but he wouldn't be there for long. Not far ahead, the great old trees pulled back, and the long, long upslope he had been climbing ended in a clearing far larger than the one where the bumblers had danced. There, an enormous tower made of metal girders rose into the sky. At the top was a blinking red light. "You have almost reached your destination," Daria said. "The North Forest Kinnickdogan is 3 wheels ahead." The click came again, even louder than before. "You really must hurry, Tim." As Tim stood looking at the tower with its blinking light, the breeze that had so frightened him while crossing the rock bridge came again. Only this time its breath was chilly. He looked up into the sky and saw the clouds that had been lazing toward the south were now racing. "It's the Stark Blast, Daria, isn't it? The Stark Blast is coming." Daria didn't reply, but Tim didn't need her to. He began to run. By the time he reached the Dogon clearing, he was out of breath and only able to trot, in spite of his sense of urgency. The wind continued to rise, pushing against him, and the high branches of the ironwood trees had begun to whisper. The air was still warm, but Tim didn't think it would stay that way for long. He needed to get under cover, and he hoped to do so in this Dogon thing. But when he entered the clearing, he barely spared a glance for the round, metal-roofed building which stood at the base of the skeletal tower with its blinking light. He had seen something else that took all his attention and stole his breath. "Am I seeing that? Am I really seeing that? Gods," he whispered. The path, as it crossed the clearing, was paved in some smooth, dark material, so bright that it reflected both the trees dancing in the rising wind and the sunset-tinged clouds flowing overhead. It ended at a rock precipice.
The whole world seemed to end there, and to begin again 100 wheels or more distant. In between was a great chasm of rushing air in which leaves danced and swirled. There were bin rusties as well. They rose and twisted helplessly in the eddies and currents. Some were obviously dead, the wings ripped from their bodies. Tim hardly noticed the great chasm and the dying birds, either. To the left of the metal road, about 3 yards from the place where the world dropped off into nothingness, there stood a round cage made of steel bars. Overturned in front of it was a battered tin bucket he knew all too well. In the cage, pacing slowly around a hole in the center, was an enormous tiger. It saw the staring, gape-mouthed boy and approached the bars. Its eyes were as large as points balls, but a brilliant green instead of blue. On its hide, stripes of dark orange alternated with those of richest midnight black. Its ears were cocked. Its snout wrinkled back from long, white teeth. It growled. The sound was low, like a silk garment being ripped slowly up a seam. It could have been a greeting, but Tim somehow doubted it. Around its neck was a silver collar. From this hung 2 objects. One looked like a playing card. The other was a key with a strange, twisted shape. Tim had no idea how long he stood captured by those fabulous emerald eyes, or how long he might have remained so, but the extreme peril of his situation announced itself in a series of low, thudding explosions. "What's that?" "Trees on the far side of the Great Canyon," Daria said. "Extreme rapid temperature change is causing them to implode. Seek shelter, Tim." The Stark Blast. What else? "How long before it gets here?" "Less than an hour." There was another of those loud clicks. "I may have to shut down." "No! I have violated Directive 19. All I can say in my defense is that it's been a very long time since I have had anyone to talk to." Click. Then, more worrisome, more ominous. Clunk. "What about the tiger? Is it the guardian of the beam?" As soon as he articulated the idea, Tim was filled with horror. "I can't leave a guardian of the beam out here to die in the Stark Blast." "The guardian of the beam at this end is Aslan," Daria said. "Aslan is a lion, and if he still lives, he is far from here in the land of endless snows. This tiger is... Directive 19!" Then an even louder clunk as she overrode the directive, at what cost Tim did not know. "This tiger is the magic of which I spoke. Never mind it. Seek shelter. Good luck, Tim. You have been my friend." Not a click this time, nor a clunk, but an awful crunch. Smoke drifted up from the plate, and the green light went out. "Daria!" Nothing. "Daria, come back!" But Daria was gone. The artillery sounds made by the dying trees were still far across that cloudy gap in the world, but there could be no doubt that they were approaching. The wind continued to strengthen, growing ever colder. High above, a final batch of clouds was boiling past. Behind them was an awful violet clarity in which the first stars had begun to appear. The whisper of the wind in the high branches of the surrounding trees had risen to an unhappy chorus of sighs. It was as if the Ironwoods knew their long, long lives were coming to an end. A great woodsman was on the way, swinging an axe made of wind. Tim took another look at the tiger. It had resumed its slow and stately pacing, as if Tim had been worth only momentary consideration. Then hurried to the Dogon. Small, round windows of real glass, very thick from the look, marched around its circumference at the height of Tim's head. The door was also metal. There was no knob or latch, only a slot like a narrow mouth. Above the slot, on a rusting steel plate, was this: "North Central Positronics Limited, North Forest Kinnock, Bend Quadrant, Outpost 9, Low Security, Use Key Card." These words were hard for him to make out because they were in a weird mixture of high and low speech. What had been scrawled below them, however, was easy. All here are dead. At the base of the door was a box that looked like the one Tim's mother had for her little trinkets and keepsakes, only of metal instead of wood. He tried to open it, but it was locked. Engraved upon it were letters Tim couldn't read. There was a keyhole of odd shape, like the letter F, but no key. He tried to lift the box and couldn't. It might have been anchored to the ground at the top of a buried stone post. A dead bin rusty smacked the side of Tim's face. More feathered corpses flew past, turning over and over in the increasingly lively air. Some struck the side of the Dogon and fell around him. Tim read the last words on the steel plate again. Use key card. If he had any doubt about what such a thing might be, he had only to look at the slot just below the words. He thought he even knew what a key card looked like, for he believed he had just seen it, along with a more recognizable key that might fit the F-shaped keyhole of the metal box. Two keys, and possible salvation, hanging around the neck of a tiger that could probably swallow him down in three bites. And since there had been no food that Tim could see in the cage, it might only take two. This was smelling more and more like a practical joke, although only a very cruel man would find such a joke amusing. The sort of fellow who might use a bad fairy to lure a boy into a dangerous swamp, perhaps. What to do? Was there anything he could do? Tim would have liked to ask Daria, but he was terribly afraid his friend in the plate, a good fairy to match the Covenant Man's bad one, was dead, killed by Directive 19. Slowly he approached the cage, now having to lean against the wind. The tiger saw him and came padding around the hole in the middle to stand by the door of the cage. It lowered its great head and stared at him with its lambent eyes. The wind rippled its thick coat, making the stripes waver and seem to change places. The tin bucket should have rolled away in the wind, but it didn't. Like the steel box, it seemed anchored in place. The bucket he left for me back home, so I could see his lies and believe them. The whole thing had been a joke, and under this bucket he would find the point of it, that final clever line, like, I can't fork hay with a spoon, or, so then I turned her over and warmed the other side, that was supposed to make folks roar with laughter. But since it was the end, why not? He could use a laugh. Tim grasped the bucket and lifted it. He expected to find the Covenant Man's magic wand underneath, but no, the joke was better than that. It was another key, this one large and ornately carved. Like the Covenant Man's seeing basin and the tiger's collar, it was made of silver. A note had been attached to the key's head with a bit of twine. Across the gorge, the trees cracked and boomed. Now dust came rolling up from the chasm in giant clouds that were whipped away in ribbons like smoke. The Covenant Man's note was brief.
Greetings, brave and resourceful boy. Welcome to the North Forest Kinnock, which was once known as the Gateway of Outworld. Here I have left you a troublesome tiger. He is very hungry. But, as you may have guessed, the key to shelter hangs around his neck. As you may have also guessed, this key opens the cage. Use it if you dare. With all regards to your mother, whose new husband will visit her soon, I remain your faithful servant, RF/MB.
The man, if he was a man, who had left him that note, was surprised by very little. But he might have been surprised by the smile on the boy's face as he rose to his feet with the key in his hand and booted away the tin bucket. It rose and flew off on the rising wind, which had now almost reached gale force. Its purpose had been served, and all the magic was out of it. Tim looked at the tiger. The tiger looked at Tim. It seemed completely unaware of the rising storm. Its tail swished slowly back and forth. He thinks I'd rather be blown away or die of the cold rather than face your claws and teeth. Perhaps he didn't see this. Tim drew the foreshot from his belt. It did for the fish thing in the swamp, and I'm sure it would do for you, Psi Tiger. Tim was once more amazed by how right the gun felt. Its function was so simple, so clear. All it wanted to do was shoot, and when Tim held it, shooting was all he wanted to do. But, oh, he saw it, Tim said, and smiled more widely. He could hardly feel the corners of his mouth drawing up because the skin of his face had begun to grow numb from the cold. Yar, he saw it very well. Did he think I would get so far as this? Perhaps not. Did he think that if I did, I'd shoot you to live? Why not? He would. But why send a boy? Why, when he's probably hung 1,000 men and cut 100 throats and turned who knows how many poor widows like my mama out on the land? Can you answer that, Psi Tiger? The tiger only stared, head lowered and tail swishing slowly from side to side. Tim put the foreshot back into his belt with one hand. With the other, he slid the ornate silver key into the lock on the cage's curved door. Psi Tiger, I offer a bargain. Let me use the key around your neck to open yon shelter, and we'll both live. But if you tear me to shreds, we'll both die. Does thee ken it? Give me a sign if thee does. The tiger gave no sign. It only stared at him. Tim really hadn't expected one, and perhaps he didn't need one. There would be water, if God willed it. I love you, Mama, he said, and turned the key. There was a thud as the ancient tumblers turned. Tim grasped the door and pulled it open on hinges that uttered a thin screaming sound. Then he stood back with his hands at his sides. For a moment, the tiger stood where it was, as if suspicious. Then it padded out of the cage. He and Tim regarded each other beneath the deepening purple sky while the wind howled and the marching explosions neared. They regarded each other like gunslingers. The tiger began to walk forward. Tim took one step back, but understood if he took another, his nerve would break and he would take to his heels. So he stood where he was. Come thee, here is Tim, son of Big Jack Ross. Instead of tearing out Tim's throat, the tiger sat down and raised its head to expose its collar and the keys that hung from it. Tim did not hesitate. Later, he might be able to afford the luxury of amazement, but not now. The wind was growing stronger by the second, and if he didn't act fast, he'd be lifted and blown into the trees where he would probably be impaled. The tiger was heavier, but it would follow soon enough. The key that looked like a card and the key that looked like an F were welded to the silver collar, but the collar's clasp was easy enough. Tim squeezed its sides at the indentations and the collar dropped off. He had a moment to register the fact that the tiger was still wearing a collar, this one made of pink hide where the fur had been rubbed away, and then he was hurrying to the Dogon's metal door. He lifted the key card and inserted it. Nothing happened. He turned it around and tried it the other way, still nothing. The wind gusted, a cold, dead hand that slammed him into the door and started his nose bleeding. He pushed back from it, turned the card upside down and tried again. Still nothing. Tim suddenly remembered something Daria had said. Had it been only 3 days ago? North Forest Kinnick Dogon is offline. Tim guessed he now knew what that meant. The flasher on the tower of metal girders might still be working, but down here the spark power that had run the place was out. He had dared the tiger, and the tiger had responded by not eating him, but the Dogon was locked. They were going to die out here just the same. It was the end of the joke, and somewhere the man in black was laughing. He turned and saw the tiger pushing its nose against the metal box with the engraving on top. The beast looked up, then nuzzled the box again. All right, Tim said. Why not? He knelt close enough to the tiger's lowered head to feel its warm breath puffing against his cold cheek. He tried the F key. It fit the lock perfectly. For a moment he had a clear memory of using the key the Covenant man had given him to open Kells's trunk. Then he turned this one, heard the click, and lifted the lid, hoping for salvation. Instead of that, he saw three items that seemed of no earthly use to him: a large white feather, a small brown bottle, and a plain cotton napkin of the sort that were laid out on the long tables behind the tree meeting hall before each year's reaptide dinner. The wind had passed gale force. A ghostly screaming had begun as it blew through the crisscrossing girders of the metal tower. The feather whirled out of the box, but before it could fly away, the tiger stretched out its neck and snatched it in its teeth. It turned to the boy, holding it out. Tim took it and stuck it in his belt beside his father's hand axe, not really thinking about it. He began to creep away from the Dogon on his hands and knees. Flying into the trees and being struck through by a branch would not be a pleasant way to die, but it might be better, quicker, than having the life crushed out of him against the Dogon while that deadly wind crept through his skin and into his vitals, freezing them. The tiger growled, that sound of slowly ripping silk. Tim started to turn his head and was slammed into the Dogon. He fought to catch another breath, but the wind kept trying to rip it out of his mouth and nose. Now it was the napkin the tiger was holding out, and as Tim finally whooped air into his lungs, it numbed his throat as it went down, he saw a surprising thing. Cy Tiger had picked the napkin up by the corner, and it had unfolded to four times its former size. That's impossible. Except he was seeing it. Unless his eyes, now gushing water that froze on his cheeks, were deceiving him, the napkin in the tiger's jaws had grown to the size of a towel. Tim reached out for it. The tiger held on until he saw the thing firmly clutched in Tim's numb fist, then let go. The gale was howling around them, now hard enough to make even a 600-pound tiger brace against it. But the napkin, that was now a towel, hung limply from Tim's hand, as if in a dead calm. Tim stared at the tiger. It stared back, seemingly at complete ease with itself and the howling world around it. The boy found himself thinking of the tin bucket, which had done as well for seeing as the Covenant man's silver basin.
"In the proper hand," he had said, "any object can be magic."
Mayhap, even a humble swatch of cotton. It was still doubled, at least doubled. Tim unfolded it again, and the towel became a tablecloth. He held it up in front of him, and although the rising gale continued to storm past on both sides, the air between his face and the hanging cloth was dead calm and warm. Tim grabbed the tablecloth that had been a napkin in both hands, shook it, and it opened once again. Now it was a sheet, and it lay easily on the ground, even though a storm of dust, twigs, and dead bin rusties flew past it and on either side. The sound of all that loose gunna striking the curved side of the Dogon was like hail. Tim started to crawl beneath the sheet, then hesitated, looking into the tiger's brilliant green eyes. He also looked at the thick spikes of its teeth, which its muzzle did not quite cover, before raising the corner of the magic cloth. "Come on, get under here, there's no wind or cold." "But you knew that, Cy Tiger, didn't you?" The tiger crouched, extended its admirable claws, and crawled forward on its belly until it was beneath the sheet. Tim felt something like a nest of wires brush down his arm as the tiger made itself comfortable. Whiskers. He shivered. Then the long, furred length of the beast was lying against the side of his body. It was very large, and half its body still lay outside the thin white covering. Tim half rose, fighting the wind that buffeted his head and shoulders as they emerged into the open air, and shook the sheet again. There was a rippling sound as it once more unfolded, this time becoming the size of a lake boat's mainsail. Now its hem lay almost at the base of the tiger's cage. The world roared and the air raged, but beneath the sheet all was still, except that was for Tim's pounding heart. When that began to settle, he felt another heart pounding slowly against his rib cage, and heard a low, rough rumble. The tiger was purring. "We're safe, aren't we?" Tim asked it. The tiger looked at him for a moment, then closed its eyes. It seemed to Tim answer enough. Night came, and the full fury of the Stark Blast came with it. Beyond the strong magic that had at first looked to be no more than a humble napkin, the cold grew apace, driven by a wind that was soon blowing at well over 100 wheels an hour. The windows of the Dogon grew inch-thick cataracts of frost. The ironwood trees behind it first imploded inward, then toppled backward, then blew southward in a deadly cloud of branches, splinters, and entire tree trunks. Beside Tim, his bedmate snoozed on, oblivious. Its body relaxed and spread as its sleep deepened, pushing Tim toward the edge of their covering. At one point, he found himself actually elbowing the tiger, the way one might elbow any fellow sleeper who is trying to steal all the covers. The tiger made a furry, growling sound and flexed its claws, but moved away a bit.
"Thank you, Sai," Tim whispered.
An hour after sunset, or perhaps it was two, Tim's sense of time had gotten lost. A ghastly screeching sound joined the howl of the wind. The tiger opened its eyes. Tim cautiously pulled down the top edge of the sheet and looked out. The tower above the Dogon had begun to bend. He watched, fascinated, as the bend became a lean. Then, almost too fast to see, the tower disintegrated. At one moment it was there, at the next it was flying bars and spears of steel thrown by the wind into a wide lane of what had been, only that day, a forest of ironwood trees. The Dogon will go next, Tim thought, but it didn't. The Dogon stayed, as it had for 1,000 years. It was a night he never forgot, but one so fabulously strange that he could never describe it, or even remember rationally, as we remember the mundane events of our lives. Full understanding only returned to him in his dreams, and he dreamed of the Stark Blast until the end of his life. Nor were they nightmares. These were good dreams. They were dreams of safety. It was warm beneath the sheet, and the sleeping bulk of his bunkmate made it even warmer. At some point, he slipped down their covering enough to see a trillion stars sprawled across the dome of the sky, more than he had ever seen in his life. It was as if the storm had blown tiny holes in the world above the world and turned it into a sieve. Shining through was all the brilliant mystery of creation. Perhaps such things were not meant for human eyes, but Tim felt sure he had been granted a special dispensation to look, for he was under a blanket of magic, and lying next to a creature even the most credulous villagers in Tree would have dismissed as mythical. He felt awe as he looked up at those stars, but also a deep and abiding contentment, such as he had felt as a child, awakening in the night, safe and warm beneath his quilt, drowsing half in and half out of sleep, listening to the wind sing its lonely song of other places and other lives. Time is a keyhole, he thought, as he looked up at the stars. Yes, I think so. We sometimes bend and peer through it, and the wind we feel on our cheeks when we do, the wind that blows through the keyhole, is the breath of all the living universe. The wind roared across the empty sky. The cold deepened, but Tim Ross lay safe and warm with the tiger sleeping beside him. At some point he slipped away himself, into a rest that was deep and satisfying and untroubled by dreams. As he went, he felt that he was very wee and flying on the wind that blew through time's keyhole. Away from the edge of the Great Canyon, over the endless forest and the Fagonard, above the Ironwood Trail, past Tree, just a brave little nestle of lights from where he rode the wind, and farther, farther, oh, very much farther, across the entire reach of Midworld to where a huge ebony tower reared itself into the heavens. I will go there. Someday I will. It was his last thought before sleep took him. In the morning, the steady shriek of the wind had lowered to a drone. Tim's bladder was full. He pushed back the sheet crawled out onto ground that had been swept clean all the way to the bone of underlying rock, and hurried around the Dogon with his breath emerging from his mouth in bursts of white vapor that were immediately yanked away by the wind. The other side of the Dogon was in the lee of that wind, but it was cold, cold. His urine steamed, and by the time he finished, the puddle on the ground was starting to freeze. He hurried back, fighting the wind for every step and shivering all over. By the time he crawled back beneath the magic sheet and into the blessed warmth, his teeth were chattering. He wrapped his arms around the tiger's heavily muscled body without even thinking, and had only a moment's fright when its eyes and mouth opened. A tongue that looked as long as a rug runner and as pink as a new earth rose emerged. It licked the side of his face, and Tim shivered again, not from fright, but from memory. His father rubbing his cheek against Tim's early in the morning, before Big Ross filled the basin and scraped his face smooth. He said he would never grow a beard like his partner, said it wouldn't suit him. The tiger lowered its head and began to sniff at the collar of his shirt. Tim laughed as its whiskers tickled his neck. Then he remembered the last two popkins. "I'll share," he said, "although we know thee could have both if thee wanted." He gave one of the popkins to the tiger. It disappeared at once, but the beast only watched as Tim went to work on the other one. He ate it as fast as he could, just in case Psi Tiger changed its mind. Then he pulled the sheet over his head and drowsed off again. When he woke the second time, he guessed it might be noon. The wind had dropped still more, and when he poked his head out, the air was a trifle warmer. Still, he guessed the false summer the Widow Smack had been so right to distrust was now gone for good, as was the last of his food. "What did thee eat in there?" Tim asked the tiger. This question led naturally to another. "And how long was thee caged?" The tiger rose to its feet, walked a little distance toward the cage, and then stretched, first one rear leg and then the other. It walked farther toward the edge of the great canyon where it did its own necessary. When it had finished, it sniffed the bars of its prison, then turned from the cage, as though it were of no interest, and came back to where Tim lay propped on his elbows, watching. It regarded him somberly, so it seemed to Tim, with its green eyes, then lowered its head and nosed back the magic sheet that had sheltered them from the Stark Blast. The metal box lay beneath. Tim couldn't remember picking it up, but he must have. If it had been left where it was, it would have blown away. That made him think of the feather. It was still safely tucked in his belt. He took it out and examined it closely, running his fingers over its rich thickness. It might have been a hawk feather. If that was, it had been half the size. Or if he had ever seen a white hawk, which he had not. "This came from an eagle, didn't it?" Tim asked. "Gan's blood! Did." The tiger seemed uninterested in the feather, although it had been eager enough to snatch it from the breath of the rising storm last evening. The long, yellow-fuzzed snout lowered and pushed the box at Tim's hip. Then it looked at him. Tim opened the box. The only thing left inside was the brown bottle, which looked like the sort that might contain medicine. Tim picked it up and immediately felt a tingle in his fingertips, very like the one he'd felt in the Covenant Man's magic wand when he passed it back and forth over the tin bucket. "Shall I open it? For it's certain thee can't." The tiger sat, its green eyes fixed unwaveringly on the tiny bottle. Those eyes seemed to glow from within, as if its very brain burned with magic. Carefully, Tim unscrewed the top. When he took it off, he saw a small, transparent dropper fixed beneath. The tiger opened its mouth. The meaning was clear enough, but... "How much?" Tim asked. "I'd not poison thee for the world." The tiger only sat with its head slightly up-tilted and its mouth open, looking like a baby bird waiting to receive a worm. After a little experimentation, he'd never used a dropper before, although he'd seen a larger, cruder version that Destry called a bull squirter. Tim got some of the fluid into the little tube. It sucked up almost all the liquid in the bottle, for there was only a bit. He held it over the tiger's mouth, heart beating hard. He thought he knew what was going to happen, for he had heard many legends of skin men, but it was impossible to be sure the tiger was an enchanted human. "I'll put it in, drop by drop," he told the tiger. "If you want me to stop before it's gone, close thy mouth. Give me a sign."